Okay, well, good morning, everyone. This morning I want to talk about something that those of you who've read a lot and listened to a lot of Dharma talks are quite familiar with. And if you're just beginning, you have this to look forward to. And that is the confusing sentences that you read when you read Buddhism and Zen. And I don't know if it made it to our brochure or not, but a good example, I think it's on the front page, you open one book, and it says to become enlightened, you have to sit Zazen or sitting meditation, right? And so you decide, I'm going to start a practice. Sounds pretty good. And then you make the mistake of picking another book up and opening it, and it says only a fool would think that in sitting meditation that you'll become enlightened, right? And so you figure, wow, these people have got to get their stories together. And then you decide, somebody says, well, Dogen, this Japanese master in the early part of the 13th century, he's kind of the founder of our lineage. So you go read Dogen, and you figure he's going to straighten this out. And what's Dogen say? He says there's no difference between sitting in meditation and enlightenment. So what's up? What's up? And today I want to talk about those statements and put them in the context of three different ways of seeing in Zen. Because you might have some enthusiasm. You know, you're reading a lot. You're listening to Dharma talks, and it sounds confusing. And I've found, maybe I've deluded myself, but I found that basically the more I sit with the material and think about it, the more straightforward it becomes. And I want to try to convey some of that understanding or perhaps misunderstanding this morning. And to do that, I'm going to use something else that Dogen said. Dogen said famously, and he wasn't the first to say it, but we usually first read it in Dogen. He said, before I started the train, mountains were mountains. And after many years of training, mountains were no longer mountains. Does it sound like what I said before? And then after many, many more years of training, mountains were just mountains again. What's that mean? And so this is kind of the confusion, and many of us are attracted to Zen just because of this confusion. And you think, well, this is great. There must be a mystery there. If I can't understand it, it's deep. But I want to say that actually it's pretty straightforward, and there are real messages there. And if we're really on the path, we really want to understand what's being said because it's fairly important. So let's start with Dogen's first statement, where Dogen says, before I started practicing, mountains were mountains. What's that mean? Here Dogen is talking, remember these are the three eyes of seeing. He's seeing through the eyes of the conventional world. And this is the world that most of us inhabit. There are rabbits and cats and dogs, there are cars. When I see you all sitting here, I think you're different people. I look through my eyes and I see Jeff right there. And so I'm subject, Jeff is object. That's the way we see. We think in terms of time and space. There's young and old and aging and tall and small. This is all the conventional world, and that's one way of seeing. Okay. Now, it's interesting, and this is the way most of us see. It's interesting that Buddhism is intent on changing that way of seeing, and that's one of its primary goals. It wants us to see at least through the second way of seeing, the second set of eyes. And what's that about? When you see through the second set of eyes, and what I'm going to say first is going to be confusing, and then hopefully we'll get to some clarity on it. But when you see through the second set of eyes, you see that things lack separateness. They lack their own essence, if you will. That the many, what I see right here, are only the one. And again, this is somewhat confusing. It's hard to make sense of it a little bit. So let's, again, lead to some, at least the way I see it, some clarification. I follow the Dalai Lama here when the Dalai Lama says ultimate reality is fields of forces. It's quanta, if you will. And what happens in quanta, things emerge, and eventually they're reabsorbed. Okay? And what emerges are things that we call cats and dogs, other people, and not just visible things, but even emotions like anger and joy. Now, these are just parts of what it means to be a human. The Buddha didn't try to explain why we are that way. He just says, this is the way we are. Okay? And that still seems kind of murky when I put it that way. Here we have fields of forces, things arise. We use words and concepts to produce boundaries of what's only one. That's only one. And so we look at a part of that fields of force, we say cat. We look at another, we say dog. Okay? And now how can we make that clearer? And I like to use the analogy of an ocean. An ocean has waves, it has currents, it has eddies, right? But it's all ocean. We wouldn't think of calling a wave other than ocean. But for pragmatic purposes, of course, we want to identify currents. If I'm sailing a boat across the Pacific, I want to know about currents. If I'm a surfer, I want to know about waves, right? But it's all ocean. So there are pragmatic reasons for dividing a whole up into its parts, at least pragmatically, even though ultimately it's only ocean. And it's the same thing with fields of forces, that it's necessary for us to actually divide a part of this, what's only one. Let's say I decide as a New Year's resolution I'm going to save money by eating rocks rather than groceries. How far would I get? Okay? So I have to make a separation between parts of what's only one. Let's say that when the talk is over, we've had our cookies, I go outside, I decide everything is empty, and I see a truck roaring down the street, and I decide I'm going to run at it and we're just going to pass through each other. That's not what emptiness is about. Splat. Things are hard. They are real. But what they lack in that kind of realness is separate existence. The many is just the one. And so it's easy to become confused in Zen when somebody says, you don't exist. Okay, you don't exist. And, of course, what they're talking about is not that physical presence, but they're talking about that separateness. They're talking about, the essence of a separate soul, separate from everything else. Okay? Now, why does it make a difference? Now, why is Buddhism interested and really intent on having us change our perception? When I go through that training, I don't look different, but I see different. And so what's the purpose? What's the meaning? And the Buddha, when he woke up, he saw humans and he said, all unenlightened beings suffer. And we use that word suffering, and my wife, who's a yoga teacher, always say, what do you do with a spiritual tradition based on suffering? That's a different talk, but what... but what he means is that there's an unease, if you will. I think Emerson said every person lives a life of quiet desperation. And it can be everything from losing a job to something real simple. Like just not feeling quite right, if you will. And so where's that come from? And the Buddha says it comes from seeing ourselves as separate individuals, as seeing ourselves as other than the one or the whole or the ultimate reality. And once we can get rid of that feeling of self that is a separate self, etc., it doesn't mean things never happen. It just means that we let go of some of that angst. So let's be clear about what suffering is and how it differs from pain, because there is a difference. Devadatta, who was one of the Buddha's many cousins, was very jealous of the Buddha. So threw a stone at him one time and hurt the Buddha. He felt pain. Leading up to the Buddha's death, he ate some tainted boar meat and felt pain. So a Buddha feels pain, but the Buddha doesn't suffer. So what's the difference? So I get up late at night because I hear a dripping sound, and it's completely dark. I can't see anything. I make my way across the living room. My toe crashes into a large vacuum cleaner, and there it's sitting. I feel pain, okay? No doubt I feel pain. But I also say, oh, poor me. I was going to go skiing this afternoon. Now I can't. My poor foot. And then I might go on and say, what kind of dolt would have left the vacuum cleaner in the middle of the room if I get them? And then suddenly you realize that you left it there. And you say, will I ever improve? My mother told me, never cross a street by yourself. Okay. And so all of that, all of everything above the pain is what we think of as dukkha or suffering, etc. And that's what we're trying to get apart. Now, here we are. In Buddhism, we refer to this world, this second way of seeing, as seeing in emptiness. Seeing in emptiness. And we don't think about it too much in our own lives, but it actually can be a very exciting place. We don't know a lot about it. Remember, this is a quantum field. There was a Big Bang. We know that that energy fields, they evolve, they change, and we don't know much about them. Emerson again said that the universe lies in the palm of great intelligence. The universe lies in the palm of great intelligence. We don't know if that's true or not. It's possible that there are energy beings as large as galaxies, etc., that have an intelligence 10,000 times greater than ours. You know, we tend to think that our intelligence somehow is it. But what happens if it's just limited, just like our ability to see or hear? We only think in terms of human thoughts, human-sized thoughts, etc. So let's say there is a great creature like that. Who knows? Whenever I talk like that, my wife says, Guy, don't talk like that in public. People will think you're crazy. But I'm making a point. And the point is, we don't know. It's an exciting area. Some years ago, I had a week after a long retreat where I was a cosmonaut. And a cosmonaut, as far as the spiritual world, it's spelled with a K rather than the C. And rather than exploring the physical universe, we really explore the spiritual universe. And every material part has a spiritual aspect, etc. It was exhilarating. It was exhilarating. We think of the ecstasy of St. Teresa. And I could see how somebody could sit in a grass hut, for 15 years, extremely excited, etc. And you don't use words, you don't use concepts, you use prajna or intuition. And off you go. We find this in Buddhism, mainly in Tibetan tradition, and also yoga, for example. Sages are great cosmonauts in that sense. But that's not our direction in our kind of Zen. We're part of a branch called Mahayana Buddhism. And rather than going up the mountain of wisdom and staying there, and it's very seductive to stay in wisdom, to stay there, etc. We go down the mountain. We follow the path of compassion. We follow the mother of all Buddhas, etc., down the mountain with the intent of saving all beings. And this is what it means to be a bodhisattva. And that's the vow we take. And we learn to see, and still a third way. And it's important to distinguish between these, the first way, the second way, and the third way. Because we come down. The second way, of course, is Dogen saying, mountains are not mountains because everything's empty, right? There can be no mountains. There's no teacher. There's no one to be taught. There's no teaching, right? And that's true emptiness, if you will. And when you read Buddhist sayings, for example, you can open a book and it'll say, the Buddha taught many people and led them to nirvana. And the very next sentence will say, the Buddha taught no one and led no one to nirvana. By now, we should know what's being said. The first sentence is a statement about conventional reality, right? The second statement is a statement about emptiness. And they're both true in their realm, the truth of conventional reality, the truth of emptiness, if you will. Okay? So when you see statements like that, you have to decide which way somebody was seeing when they wrote that. So here we are in the Bodhisattva, and we're coming down the mountain, etc. We're trying to liberate all beings. But we're also seeing the world different. And this is very important. Because the Bodhisattva, when the Bodhisattva reaches full realization, doesn't just see emptiness, but sees no difference between emptiness and the conventional world. That there's only one, right? And that's quite a different, and it takes a lot of training to actually see that. This is where the one-hand clapping is. How could there be two? For two hands symbolize two worlds, right? There can only be one. And what's that sound? It's the roar of emptiness as it cascades through eternity, right? And so to see that really is an advanced teaching. But you're seeing it different. That again, and so this is why Dogen says, I see after all of that training, mountains are just mountains. And what he means by just, of course, is that they're just mountains in all of their emptiness, all combined with emptiness itself and conventional reality. And this is how we see, basically, from a human perspective. Now, if we go back to the conventional realm, in the conventional realm, there's all kinds of stages and ladders. There's all kinds of different practices. Some are pretty introductory. Karma, for example, and merit are very introductory. Things like the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, these are very introductory. As your awareness increases, you find that you're working with the witness or the observer, if you know what I'm talking about, that which observes, etc. You can actually see the eagle. You're learning to separate yourself from the things around you and see some emptiness. And then finally, before you break through the clouds and the mountains into the clarity of emptiness, you're reading Nagarjuna. And you're reading the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, in which he takes all of our common notions, motion, bodies, aggregates, even a nirvana, and even emptiness itself, and demonstrates that they are all empty, that there's no foundation, nothing to stand on, and that carries you off into emptiness. And, of course, once you reach emptiness and you look back, you realize that all of those teachings, all of those guides, guide dogs if you need them, Sherpas, whatever it takes, etc., basically we're all empty. The Buddha said my teaching was just a raft. When I cross the river, leave it behind. One of my favorite sayings in this about this is by Wittgenstein, a famous early 20th century the European philosopher. In the very last paragraph of the Tractatus, this very famous philosophical work, he says, if you've understood me, you realize that all of my words are nonsensical. They're used just to change your perception. They're like a ladder that's carried you up. Now throw the ladder away. Now this guy had to be reading Zen, right? If you will. Nagarjuna, who's the second great Buddha. Nagarjuna, and Nagarjuna wrote great tons of stuff, okay? When somebody asked him, what's your view, what's your teaching? He says, I have no thesis. And this is Nagarjuna's famous statement, I have no thesis. In emptiness, how can you have a thesis, right? How can you have a thesis? So Nagarjuna says, my words are only expedients. They're only tools, etc. And in the very in his famous Karika, there are 32 chapters. The last chapter, he compares words to bubbles, to shadows, things like this. Let them go. They serve a purpose. Don't hold on to them, etc. And then when we look at the teaching of the Bodhisattva, what's the teaching of a Bodhisattva? And the teaching of a bodhisattva really doesn't have to do with attachment to the self, to the belief in the reality of objects, but really has to do with attachment to the very tools that the bodhisattva uses to bring another person to enlightenment. And we call these tools Buddha dharmas, and they're things like the idea of a path, the idea of enlightenment, the idea of nirvana, the idea of practice. These are just tools. Let them go. They don't exist. And so here's the bodhisattva. Of course, you have to save all beings. We know there are no beings to be saved, right? There is no teaching, etc. There's no teacher. And yet, you're the teacher, and you're a being to be saved, and here's the teaching. Okay? And so the great challenge for the bodhisattva is to learn to let go. And it's hard. In Zen, we have a saying, stepping off a 100-foot pole. It's kind of a koan, what happens. And of course, if you step off in emptiness, of course, there is no past, there is no future, there is no time, there is no space. When you live in emptiness, you don't see through your face. There's no subject here, no object there, right? That you are just part of one. You're part of one. And if there's no space and no time, and somebody asks you, what was your face before the Big Bang? You can pick up a mug and say, none other than this. Because if you understand it, you understand it's all one, if you will. So back to the 100-foot pole. One of the hardest challenges for the bodhisattva is to step off, because it means no attachment. No attachment. And then remember, in emptiness, no up, no down, nothing to land on. Now, in part of the, one of the hardest things, of course, is to realize that there's no ground. There's nothing to hold on to. There's just your perception of this oneness, what this one hand clapping, if you will. That's it. And many people find that scary. That's hard. You know, they want something to attach to. They'd rather live in the world of samsara and suffering because we talk about real things. And here there's nothing. And then, of course, you're free. You're free from all of your suffering and your attachments, even though you can still feel pain. Well, that's my three views. And one could say more, but I think when you listen to a Dharma talk, when you read a Buddhist text, ask yourself, which way of seeing is that written from? Okay. When Dogen says there's no difference between sitting in meditation and being enlightened, of course, he's looking through the eyes of an experienced bodhisattva, and he's seeing the emptiness in those practices. Okay, and if somebody says, there are no dharmas, and in Zen, of course, where do we start? Well, how does Zen fit into this? In Zen, we start from the other side of the river. We've crossed the river with a raft, and that's why it's such a difficult practice. We have that sense of emptiness, or we should, etc. And so we talk in terms of, no raft, no teaching, just sit, okay? And so you can see, basically, it's hard. Of course, there are many other things that we could talk about. And, for example, we could ask, well, what are the various stages and steps, and how do we actually work our way along the path of the non-existent path through conventional reality? How do we do that? If we're a bodhisattva, and we're a fledgling bodhisattva, how do we break out of the iron chains of emptiness? It's very subductive, if you will. And how do we learn to see How do we learn to let go of those attachments so that we can step off that 100-foot pole? Okay. Enough. Now, I'd like to say no comments, no questions. And when somebody says, but, I want to say, well, why did I say that? What face, what point of view did I ask say that statement from? And, of course, it's from the statement of emptiness, right? So, anyway. Any comments or questions? Right? I've given up and trying to keep people quiet and not asking questions. I think it's the other way around. I think emptiness is a metaphor for fields of forces.
I feel like that makes emptiness a thing.
Go ahead.
I feel like that makes emptiness a thing.
Well,
of the phenomenal.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the thing about emptiness is that you can't say anything from within it, because there's no place to stand. So everything you can say about emptiness, you're saying from a conventional stand. And so when I talk about the bodhisattva and this final realization, you realize, of course, that that idea of ultimate reality is a conventional idea. And that's part of its collapse, into this oneness. And I didn't say that. You know, when I give a talk, I have all these great ideas, and then an hour later, I think, geez, I didn't say half of them. But that is a good point, and it's something to really work on. It. The best source I've found for that discussion is still the Dalai Lama. He meets every second year, and I want to call it the Mind and Life Institute. I think that's what it's called. He meets with the leading scientists from throughout the world, and these are physicists, of course. They're neurobiologists, and the Dalai Lama. Remember, a lot of our teachings come from a classical India, 2,500 years ago. They come from medieval Japan. They come from medieval China, and so to hold on to that is somehow inviolable. Is dogma. Okay? Dogma. And the Buddha, if the Buddha was here, the Buddha would be first to say, that we want to see reality as we can. And there's a story about, and we can't, it's hard, unless you've lived among other people who are quite different than we are, it's hard to believe how different people see the world. You know, that we're becoming such a one world now that we tend to all think of it the same. But I worked for a number of years with a Tibetan teacher in Los Angeles called Ken McLeod. And he was became a translator for Tibetan lamas. And he went with one of the lamas up into the subarctic. Of course, it was, I forget if it's summer or whenever, when it's light all the time. And the next morning, this lama comes running up and says, Ken, something's wrong. It was light all night. It didn't get dark. Ken McLeod took an orange and an apple and tried to explain basically, here's an astronomer, how the sun works. Did you change our signs, no Aries and all that? No.
It wasn't me.
Anyway, this llama, had a completely different cosmology, a completely different understanding of the nature and structure of the world, of the earth, completely different. And so we have to keep that in mind. So the Dalai Lama says is that there's something that we thought was, and we think it's false, change it. But he insists that Buddhism, particularly in the realm of the cosmonaut with a K, you know, has a huge amount to offer. And so he has this dialogue in numerous books. And if you're interested in any of that, I suggest you you look at that. Sure.
Emptiness and oneness, how is that the intent of connection?
Yeah. Remember, words, you know, like oneness and, you know, the many in the one or the one in the many, when you come off the mountain, you're seeing the one in the many. But those are just conventional realm expressions, you know what I mean, that we use to, you know, you have to talk about it somehow. You know what I mean? Katagiri, I think his second book was called something like "You Have to Say Something." You know what I mean? And so, if you want to say something about emptiness, then you start talking that way. You know what I mean? But and so the oneness is this idea of this what I call fields of forces, what the Dalai Lama calls fields of forces. And in Buddhism, we tend to refer to that as emptiness. And I don't want to go into great detail, but it's really emptiness almost as a quality rather than the form itself. You know what I mean? It's a quality of it. It's the nature of it. But again, everything that we're saying, you can begin to see as we work on this and work on this and work on this, you see the difficulty we have in expressing ideas. Because we're talking about something that another Wittgenstein saying was, no, don't talk about what can't be talked about. You know what I mean? And that's very Zen saying. Don't talk about what can't be talked about. You know what I mean? And so it's just this idea. And so part of the training is to see through concepts, to see through world, to see through boundaries. And I mean, to see how we divide things up, if you will. I don't know if I answered your question at all. Probably not, you know. I think we're getting close to cookie time. Thank you all very much. Oh, yes.
I understand how you separated and how you interchanged to kind of match up and describe whatever you're at. But what is the ultimate intent from being able to identify it, just to be able to cope through life in various ways? What is the next step?
Yeah, the next step when there are no steps. You know, I was gonna close originally by saying, why practice? You know, why go on the journey? You know, why spend the energy? You know, why not just stay in the conventional world?
Not so much staying in the conventional.
Yeah.
Is it supposed to allow you to navigate a little easier through?
I think what it is, and this is my understanding, is what we're really talking about is a change of perception. You know, how we see the world. And, for example, you know, I have to go back to conventional reality, that we're all trapped in ideas about conventional success. You know, do I have the best job, the biggest house, you know, things like that. Part of it is to have you let go of those things. It doesn't mean you can't live in a big house or have a great job. You know, it's just how you perceive all that. So a lot has to do with perception. That's the first part. And then the second part has to do with the idea of freeing all beings. And when we're done, there'll be a chant where we start, beings are numberless, freeing all beings. And so the idea is, how do you do that? How do you do that? You can do great harm, if I can put it that way, by applying the Dharma, the Buddha Dharmas, ideas like enlightenment and the path and nirvana, if you do it unskillfully and you don't understand it. And so the first part is to see the difference between suffering and pain, and then the second part is to see how one can be what a skilled teacher is. And I probably didn't answer your question again, but at least, you know. Now let me end by saying that when anyone thinks, you know, that there's one answer in Buddhism, then you don't understand Buddhism. For every, it's extremely diverse. There's no pope. For everyone's ideas, there are 18 opposing schools. You know what I mean? And I just wanted to point that out. That besides seeing through these three, eyes or ways of seeing, that you're going to also run into a huge amount of confusion just based upon, the way the discipline has developed through time. Okay, thank you very much.